Okay, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
It is unfortunately entirely apropos that we are talking about the subject that we're talking about this morning in light of the events of the last few days, but I don't want to let that preoccupy us. So I'm just going to say at the outset that let's just be mindful of all of the questions and the uncertainties and the dynamics that are now at play in terms of the conflict that's going on in the wider world, many of which have to do with the topic that we're talking about this morning. And that's about all I'm going to say about that. So we can discuss that more later if you'd like. But today what we're going to do is we're going to continue exploring this idea of justice, peace, and dignity from a Christian perspective. Last week, Chris did a good job of setting us up by pointing us to many of the biblical passages and many of the themes in our faith that orient us towards a preoccupation or a concern with justice, peace, and dignity. And today what I want to do is I want to expand that conversation just a little bit by taking a look at some other elements of our faith and practice that give us a slightly broader picture of kind of the questions that we are always kind of forced to confront and forced to ask as we work through those issues. And here's the most important slide for you. This is everything that I have to say to you today. This is a short passage from 1 Peter. You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, in order that you may proclaim the mighty acts of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, now you have received mercy. Everything that Christians want to say about justice, peace, and dignity goes back to that. Doesn't go back to that verse specifically, but it goes back to the idea that that verse articulates. Goes back to the principle or the reality to which that verse bears witness. So everything I'm going to say today about justice, peace, and dignity hinges on this more fundamental conviction. Namely that the Christian vision for justice, peace, and dignity is grounded not in what we have done for God or for ourselves or for any other person, but is grounded rather in what God has done for us. Once we did not know what justice was, but now we do. Once we did not know what peace looked like, but now we do. Once we had no idea what dignity was about, but now we do. Because of what God has done in making us his people. Okay, so that's our conversation for today. Just by way of review, this is what Chris talked about last week. He talked a little bit about the baptismal covenant, and he pointed out that if you take a look at the covenant in the prayer book, you'll see three big sections. The first three articles of the baptismal covenant all have to do with believing. As Christians, we confess a particular way of understanding the world and understanding God, and that informs directly our understanding of justice, peace, and dignity. Without that understanding of God, our understanding of everything else changes. So believing, an essential part of the covenant. The covenant also bears witness to a particular kind of belonging. The covenant calls us into a particular kind of community, to be a particular kind of people. We heard that in the reference to 1 Peter. And being a member of that community involves behaving in a particular way. And this is where we get the language for justice, peace, and dignity. That particular reference is found in the last article of the baptismal covenant. Will you strive? Not just will you hope for, or will you long for, or will you pray for, but will you strive? Will you work for justice, peace, and dignity? That's what the covenant very much points us to. So this is the framework within which any conversation that we want to have as Christians needs to happen. Now, at the very outset here, we can acknowledge that we may find ourselves called into conversations about justice, peace, and dignity that does not take for granted this particular framework. We may find ourselves called into questions about justice, peace, and dignity based on our identity as fill in the blank, as Americans, as Democrats, as Republicans, as whatever, right? Members of any number of other communities that may have somewhat different accounts of justice, peace, and dignity. So one of the tensions that we find ourselves wrestling with as Christians is how do we bring our convictions about these things to bear within contexts and conversations and communities that do not necessarily subscribe to this particular way of accounting for those things. That's a tension that the covenant immediately introduces into our conversation. But all that is just by way of review. Okay. Today, where I want to start is just quickly kind of reorienting us to the conversation. the questions that I think are most pressing on us today in consequence of where Chris left us last week are these. Does the church have, can the church articulate or offer a constructive vision for what justice, peace, and dignity are about? Is there such a thing as a distinctly Christian account of those? Well, I've already alluded to the fact that there is. We'll talk a little bit more about that. What then is the relationship between the church's vision of justice, peace, and dignity and other accounts? I alluded to that as well. And how then should our answers to these questions inform our faith and practice? If the first two questions can be answered in the affirmative, what does that mean for the way we live our lives as Christians? Obviously, we're having this conversation because of any number of concerns and questions and issues and conflicts that we have seen arise in the world in recent times. And I'm not just talking about the last couple days. I'm talking about the pervasive sense that we seem to have as a culture that all is not as it should be. We seem to find ourselves increasingly incapable of having civil conversations with one another across political lines, across social lines, across economic lines, across moral lines, ethical, whatever. What is it that's going on in the broader culture that is making it so difficult for us to articulate a comprehensive vision for justice, peace, and dignity that enables people of different traditions and different communities and different convictions to move forward? That's the question that's on the table. And we see this question playing out not just in one area of our lives or in two areas of our lives, but in many areas of our lives. Our understanding of justice, peace, and dignity will affect the way we think about every one of these issues. Every one of these other realities is to some degree or another immediately informed by our account of justice, by our understanding of peace, and by our understanding of human dignity and human identity that is behind it. So whether we're talking about war, whether we're talking about immigration, whether we're talking about healthcare, technology, you name it, these days, just about every one of these, I mean, you can pick a fight on with about any one of these with just about anybody, right? I mean, if you want to, right? And we know where the buttons are, right? I mean, we're so conditioned now to the cultural conflict that we know how to start an argument about any one of these at any moment with anyone. Isn't that fun? Makes it rather hard for us to pursue any kind of coherent vision for cultural flourishing. So we're not talking about just a problem over here or a problem over there. We're talking about a problem. And the one towards the bottom there, pluralism, seems to be one of the most pronounced issues that presses on us when we start to wrestle with these questions. What do we do with the fact that there seems to be more than one way of accounting for justice, peace, and dignity? What do we do with the fact that we've got different competing accounts, not complementary accounts, but mutually exclusive accounts? That's a challenge. I want to take a note here from Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, who suggested that the fundamental issue that is actually at stake behind all of those conversations is this one. Williams has said, the issue here is anthropology. Unless we have a coherent model of what sort of humanity we want to nurture in our society, we shall continue to be at sea over how we teach, how we vote, how we save and buy and sell, how we entertain ourselves, how we think about the beginning and the end of life. It's from a very short book of lectures that Williams did on theological anthropology called Being Human. Now that small little book is part of a little trilogy that Williams did, one of which is called Being Christian, the other of which is called Being a Disciple, and then the third of which is called Being Human. And in this particular book, what Williams is really trying to get at is that more fundamental question about how we understand justice, peace, and dignity as Christians. If being a Christian entails this, and if being a disciple entails that, what then should we say about the way that we as Christians make sense of what it means to be a human person in today's world? So I'm going to be spending a lot of the rest of my time talking specifically about this question. What is a person? What is a human being? How does our understanding of what it means to be a human being inform the way we think about justice, peace, and dignity? Part of the issue that we're dealing with culturally is that we have seen over the last 35 years or so a proliferation of options as to pardon me.
Need some water?
Yeah, I've got some. Talk amongst yourselves for a minute.
Don't get carried away. Okay.
This is a list of editions of a book that was first released in 1974, not written by a Christian, right? Not written for a religious audience. Notice the title of the edition that was released in 1974, Seven Theories of Human Nature. You see the problem, right? 24 years later, we had 10 theories of human nature. Then we had 12 theories of human nature. Now we have 13 theories of human nature. This does not seem to be helping. This is, in some respects, despite its own intentions and despite its own best effort, this is the problem right here. Right? I mean, if we want to talk about what it takes to have a cultural vision for human flourishing that is grounded in a robust sense of justice and dignity and peace, and if we want to suggest, as everyone whose work is described in these, everyone would affirm, yes, anthropology is the heart of the problem. Well, okay. The reason that anthropology is so important is because it pulls together a number of fundamental questions that really cannot be addressed apart from one another. In other words, anthropology presents us with what I've described here as a polycentric problem. You have to answer several questions simultaneously. You can't answer one question and then go to the next logical question and then go to the next logical. It doesn't work that way. When it comes to answering questions about anthropology, you have to simultaneously engage in multiple questions having to do with the nature of the universe, right? The nature of reality itself will bear on our understanding of the nature of humanity and vice versa. There also has to be some diagnosis, some articulation of the problem. What is the problem that besets us that seems to make it so difficult for us to pursue peace, justice, and dignity? And then, what is the solution to that problem? All four of those questions depend on one another in ways that make them irreducible. We're not going to solve one of those questions and then proceed to the next and then proceed to the next. Wherever we start, we will implicitly be referring to the other three. So this is why anthropology is potentially such a complicated subject. And if you were to look at the last edition of the book that I mentioned, the 13 theories of human nature, there they are. There's the 13. And I've even added a 14th just for fun. The next edition, I'm sure, will have this one. So the thing to note about these, the thing that if we really wanted to kind of dig into this question, the thing we would want to ask is, what do each of these say about the nature of reality? What do each of these say about the nature of the human person, what it means to be a human being? What do each of these say is the problem? How do they diagnose the ills of the human condition? And then what do they then propose as a solution to that problem? Now, some of these we will find lining up fairly close with one another, such that we might say, well, these kind of complement one another and fill one another out, so there's some helpful alignment there. But if we look at all of them alongside one another, some of them mutually exclude others. And that's where the rubber hits the road. Because it's really nice if you can kind of line up a number of complementary perspectives and say, oh, look, they all kind of point in the same general direction. Isn't that nice? That's easy. The problem comes when you start having perspectives that mutually exclude one another. For example, is there life after death or not? That is a fundamental question about the nature of reality that these perspectives are going to disagree on. And how you answer that question will directly inform what you want to say about human beings. So what do you do if you've got two traditions over here that say, well, there's something out there, we're not quite sure of what it is, but there's something beyond the grave. And then you've got two or three other traditions that say, absolutely not. There's nothing. There's nothing beyond the grave. We are deluding ourselves if we think that there's life beyond death. And that's part of the problem. Now what do you do? How do you begin to resolve those kinds of disagreements? Okay, so there's our 13 perspectives. The last one that was not included in the last edition of that book is the one that I appended at the bottom, transhumanism. And this has to do with the relationship between how we understand human nature vis-a-vis technology. vis-a-vis the introduction of things like artificial intelligence, and vis-a-vis the possibility of things like uploading minds to the internet, and, you know, vis-a-vis all of that stuff, the singularity, blah, blah, blah. How does that affect the way we think about what a human being is? Is a human being distinctive if computers can think? Are bodies necessary if we imagine that one day it might be possible to upload a brain to a computer? Do you have to have a body to be a person? Well, you know, anyway, there they are. Yeah. So Williams, back to Williams. Williams points out this kind of another way of teasing out the inextricable nature of these questions, the questions that these different authors are wrestling with, having to do with the nature of reality, the nature of what it means to be a human being. Williams suggests that a loss of the sense of the sacred, a loss of the sense of being answerable to an intelligible gift from beyond ourselves, in the long run, entails more than simply the loss of God. It may entail the loss of the distinctively human. In other words, William is saying, if you deny God, you automatically and necessarily deny a particular way of thinking about human beings. Those two go together. Our sense of what it means to be a human being depends largely on our understanding of who God is. Change one, you will change the other, irrespective of what you intend. And if there is one great intellectual challenge for our day, it is the pervasive sense. We are in danger of losing our sense of the human. The fact that we've got 14 options on the table now, right, each of which has their own little nuance, only kind of highlights the challenge that Williams has addressed. So Williams suggests that this is a two-sided problem. Others, Mark Taylor, suggest this. No, this is actually a four-sided problem. It just keeps getting more and more fun. So Taylor is a theologian who works in postmodern theory, and Taylor has suggested that one of the things that we have seen in Western culture during the 20th century and since that time is a fundamental shift in the way in which we think about four things. Not just one thing, not just two things, but four things. And these, Taylor says, are inextricably related. We have begun to think differently about God because God is no longer culturally perceived as important to human flourishing. Taylor describes that as the death of God. Culturally speaking, we no longer assume that you need to be religious to be a good person, or you need to be religious to have things like justice, peace, and dignity. You can do without God. Culturally, I mean, we can have conversations about whether or not that's true, but Taylor's point is a cultural one. As a culture, Taylor says, we have shifted. And that has led, Taylor agrees with Williams, that has led to the disappearance of the self. Our understanding of what it meant to be a human being was grounded in a particular understanding of who God is. Because God has died, so to speak, because the culture has shifted on its understanding of who God is, our understanding of what it means to be a human being has likewise shifted. That has then led to subsequent consequences that we did not anticipate, one of which is the end of history. History no longer makes sense to us. The idea that there is a pattern, or that there is a direction, or that there is a meaning, or that there is anything whatsoever going on in history other than a series of accidents, that possibility has vanished. We now no longer know how to make sense of history. We no longer know how to make sense of our past, and we no longer know how to make sense of where we think we're going in any sense of future. So we seem to be stuck on a flywheel that is just kind of endlessly revolving. And finally, Taylor describes what he calls the closing of the book, the eclipse of any sense of shared reason. There is no longer a rationality or a standard for truth to which we can appeal in the midst of all the different ways in which we think about God and humanity and history and all the rest of it, justice, peace, and dignity. Used to be, back in the day, we expected that there was this thing called reason to which all human beings, if we simply presented them with the appropriate evidence and the appropriate arguments, would be able to recognize and say, oh yes, of course, that's the way to sort things out. That's the way to decide. This is true, this is false. This is good, this is bad. Taylor said that's over. At least culturally, for the time being, we seem to be trying to get by without any sense of what reason actually involves. And that leaves us in a rather difficult place. Okay? So, let me just pause there and just see how everyone's doing. I've been throwing a lot of information at you. Y'all feel good about where? He didn't know this was going to be a happy time. Yeah, Taylor's book was written in 84. Williams's book was written in 2018.
My Lord, so much of that has happened even more since the book was written.
Right, exactly. I think Taylor was certainly not the first to recognize those problems. There were people who were writing about these problems as early as, probably the 50s. I mean, if you really wanted to kind of dig back into it, it really started with a complete reevaluation of Western civilization after World War II. Western civilization stepped back after World War I and World War II and said, what just happened? We were the most advanced, we were the most developed, we were the most technologically sophisticated. We thought we were it. We thought human civilization had reached its peak, and look what we just did. What happened there? And ever since that time, these questions have been on the table. Okay, please. Yeah, the 13 ways of thinking about human nature.
They seem to be in chronological order in terms of when they were promulgated first. And they don't necessarily build on one another.
Oh, absolutely not. No. No, the comment was those 13 different views of human nature that we saw listed earlier, that they seem to have been presented in a rough chronological order. And that's right. I mean, that's what the authors of the book intended. And looking at the way in which our understanding of human nature has developed historically. Okay, let me keep going here. So, in light of the problem, right, in light of the issues that we've been talking about, what does the church, what do we as Christians, and what specifically do we as Anglican Christians want to confess about human nature? Well, there's an answer to that question, and it's found in our catechism, and it's found in other places. But if you wanted to start looking for an answer to this question, you would go to the back of the prayer book, to the catechism, and you would see that the first question there in the catechism is, what does it mean to be a human being? What is a human being? What is human nature? What is it about? And here is the answer that the prayer book gives. Human beings are part of God's creation. That is important. We do not stand above the creation or outside the creation. We are enmeshed within the creation. Creation is good. And we are created to enjoy creation and to care for it. We are here as God's stewards, working on behalf of God to share in the oversight and the sovereignty of the world. We are made in the image of God. What does that mean? Well, we punted on that one. We actually snuck in a several different definitions there. The question of what it means to bear the divine image is one that has a long history in the theological tradition, and people have given different answers. We opted for all of them. We said, we think it has something to do with choice, and we think it has something to do with being created, and we think it has something to do with our capacity to love, our capacity for reason, our capacity for relationship. Somewhere in that nexus of features and characteristics is what it means to be a bearer of the divine image. But all of them in different ways point to that fundamental reality from a Christian perspective. And here's the diagnosis of the problem. We have misused our freedom. We have misused our choice. We have misused our love. We have misused our capacity for reason and for relationship. And we have made wrong choices. And in so doing, we have tried to put ourselves in the place of God. And our help now is in God alone. And God has first helped us by revealing himself through nature, through history, and through Israel, through the prophets. And God then helped us further by revealing himself through Jesus and the Spirit. And that kind of preamble, if you will, that analysis of the human condition and that analysis of human identity, that begins everything else that the Catechism has to say. So as Anglicans, we put the question of what it means to be a human being front and center in our articulation of the faith. You want to understand who you are. If you want to understand what kind of a world we live in, if you want to understand anything else about what the church is going to confess, about what the church is going to do, it's grounded in some way, shape, or form in this understanding of what it means to be a human person. Okay? That's where we start, at least in the Catechism. That then invites us back to the covenant, back to the baptismal covenant. If we reread the covenant now, in light of the convictions of the catechism, if we kind of put the catechism and the covenant alongside one another, then we begin to tease out some other elements of what it means to be human that the covenant gives to us. We are created to be, by virtue of the beliefs that we hold about God, God is one who makes us his friends. Right? I'm drawing here on the language that Jesus uses in John 15 especially, but also other places. Jesus says to his disciples, I do not call you servants any longer, I call you friends, because I have revealed everything to you that my Father has revealed to me, and I now involve you. I give you the same power, and I involve you in the same work that I myself am doing. The Father has sent me, I am sending you. And it is by virtue of your participation in the mission that I myself am engaged in that you are my friends. We heard this morning, if you've been to worship already, if you haven't, you'll hear it in the gospel lesson. We hear that we are born not once, but twice. First born of the flesh, then born of the spirit. And we have heard that the faith that we confess invites us to live according to an understanding of wisdom and power and peace and justice and dignity that may look a little different from everybody else's. I'm riffing here on what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1 about the wisdom and the power of God. The world counted wisdom in a particular way. The world counts power in a particular way, but the cross undermines both of those. The world defines peace in a particular way. The world defines dignity in a particular way. The world defines justice in a particular way. Ours is probably going to be different, because ours is based in an understanding of the wisdom and the power of God and not in anything that we ourselves possess. This sense of belonging to God, friendship with God, also involves a sense of belonging to a community. We do not find ourselves cast into life as individuals. We are persons. Those are not the same thing. And that's kind of unusual for us to hear as late modern Westerners, because we're used to thinking of persons as individuals. Different things. An individual is a being who exists on their own, more or less autonomous, only enters into relationships in an accidental way. What do you have that I need? What do I have that you need? Let's make a deal. A person is relational from the get-go. We recognize that we are fundamentally connected and dependent on one another even before we even enter into any kind of conscious awareness of that relationship. So to be a person is inherently relational. And that's quite different from being an individual. In other words, we don't negotiate our relationships. We are fundamentally in relationship with one another from the time we're born to the time we die. And our sense of belonging to this community and our sense of connection to one another, our sense of relationship to God and to creation, shapes the way that we order our life as a community, and it shapes the way that we then behave in the world. We go out and we proclaim a message of grace and acceptance and reconciliation for all people. We go out and we proclaim a particular understanding of peace, justice, and dignity, but it is one that it is grounded in our particular confession as to what we believe God has done, especially what God has done through Jesus Christ. So if we put the catechism alongside the baptismal covenant, a particular picture of what it means to be a human person really begins to kind of come into focus here. We can further flesh that out by just making a few other additional observations. All of this orients us to being a people who are in the world, but not of the world. We are a people who are called to be a sign to the rest of the world of what human flourishing actually looks like. And one of the things that we have to say to the world, this is back to the reference that we saw to 1 Peter at the very beginning of the presentation, one of the things we have to say to the world is, you're not going to make sense of your life. You're not going to make sense of this world. You're not going to make sense of anything unless you recognize that there is something beyond this world. And it is that thing beyond this world that gives this world its meaning and its purpose. That's not to deny the goodness of this world, but it is rather to say that just as we ourselves are inherently relational, the world as a whole is inherently relational. And it's that relationship that grounds the world and that gives the world its sense of meaning and purpose and direction. And when you live your life in accordance with that relationship, then justice is possible. Then dignity is possible. Then peace is possible. take yourself out of that relationship, and it's anybody's guess as to whether it's going to work. So by virtue of that fact, we move out into the world dedicated to the work of reconciliation, because we know there's problems. We know there's problems. We don't have to deny the problems. We don't have to pretend there aren't any problems. We can go out into the world confident that we have been given everything we need to overcome the problems because of what God has done on our behalf. And as we go out, we also find ourselves called to bear the weakness and the brokenness of the world. Because, again, this is what God has done on our behalf. So our call to be human persons, by virtue of what it is that the only truly human person who's ever existed, Jesus of Nazareth, by virtue of what we saw that human person do, we recognize that's what an authentic human person does. An authentic human person pursues peace, justice, and dignity by bearing the brokenness of others, by taking it on himself, and by helping others redeem it. That shapes the life that we share with one another, and it shapes the way that we position ourselves in the world. And this also then reminds us that as Christians, we need to keep last things last. And that's obviously different from keeping first things first. This is keeping last things last. What do I mean by last things? By last things, I'm using technical language there that is drawn from Christian theology. When theologians talk about the last things, they're talking about the ultimate consummation and fulfillment of creation. They're talking about final judgment. They're talking about eternal life. So when we talk about the last things, as Christians, we need to remember that there is more beyond this life, and that it is the hope of that life. It is the hope of new life. It is the hope and the expectation and the promise of resurrection that ultimately orients our sense of who we are as people. Our sense of people is not limited to what we understand about our lives and ourselves based on what happens to us in this life. Ultimately, our sense of who we are and the meaning of our lives and the direction and the purpose of our lives points to the life to come. Now, we can have a long conversation about the continuity between those two, and that would be a lot of fun, but for today, right now, our purposes in this conversation, the most important part for us to recognize there is that what that means is that makes us consistently cautious about our ability to ever fully enact peace, justice, and dignity in worldly terms. If we ever fall into the trap as Christians of thinking that we're going to impose our particular view of peace, justice, and dignity in other people, things are going to get ugly. And that's not just true of us, that's true of anybody, anytime. Anyone tries to impose a view of peace, justice, and dignity on others with the expectation that there is nothing beyond this life, that's when violence happens. And that is the thing that we as Christians have that helps us avoid that problem. We have a vision of what human life and human meaning and human purpose is about that takes us beyond this life. That makes us cautious. That makes us patient. That makes us willingness to bear in the midst of brokenness. That's what gives us the capacity to do the work of reconciliation, because we're playing the very long game. We don't have to worry about the short game, because we know that the game is actually one that goes beyond this world. I think that that idea is summarized really well by an Anglican historian and monastic named Neville Figgis. Who wrote a book. Figgis was one of the first ones to engage in the reanalysis of Western civilization that I was talking about earlier. Figgis saw it coming. Even before World War I was over, Figgis saw it coming and said, this is not going to go well. And this is going to basically shake the very foundations of our civilization. And within that, within the context of Figgis' analysis, he undertook an examination of what he thought it was going to mean for the church to then pursue its mission. He says, in light of the cultural collapse that's coming, what is it going to mean to be Christian? What is it going to mean to be the church? One thing that Figgis suggested was this. It is the essence of the church to be different from the world. And her mission is to proclaim that difference. Whenever we try to sanctify the world by raising it to the level of the church, we commonly succeed only in lowering the life of the church to accommodate it to the practice of the world. Now, the difference there is not difference for its own sake, right? It's not difference for the sake of being provocative. It's difference that is grounded in that vision of a much larger life and a much larger meaning than anything that you could possibly have if you define human existence and human being strictly in terms of life in this world. Anytime you try to articulate an anthropology that is grounded in life in this world that does not take account of life in the next, Figgis said, you've lost it as a Christian. It is by definition our vision of the promise of new life given to us in Jesus Christ. That grounds our sense of who we are. That is the meaning of our life. And if that's true, then that becomes the foundation for sorting out how we think about peace, justice, and dignity. So in light of that, how do we then, as Christians, live? We live in faith, we live in hope, and we live in love. And by living in those ways, we undo, or we solve, as it were, the four-sided problem that Mark Taylor talked about earlier. By living in faith and hope and in love, we rehabilitate reason. We show the world, yes, reason is possible, and here's what it looks like. And guess what's at the heart of it? Guess what's at the very heart of what it means to be a reasonable person? Faith. Religious faith. We're able to live in hope because we bear witness to the goodness of creation. History does have meaning. History does have a purpose. Human beings are worth something. There is something ineradicably valuable about each and every individual person, and we can affirm that as Christians, and that gives us the capacity to bear witness to hope, and that then enables us to live in love and to pursue reconciliation with all people, to pray for our enemies, to pray for those who need healing from brokenness, to pray for those who are divided from one another for whatever reason. As we live in faith and in hope and in love, we bear witness in word and in deed to the presence and the activity of the living God. And that, again, takes us back to the beginning of the catechism. We are who we are because God has made us that way. Not because of anything we've done, not because of any inherent capacity we have, not because we're so clever or we're so strong or we're so cool, because of what God has done on our behalf by making us friends. Ultimately, our vision as Christians of what peace, justice, and dignity look like are grounded in what God has done for us in Jesus Christ. And everything follows from there. You want to do some more poking around in addition to the books that I mentioned along the way? These are some other good resources that you might look at. Okay? Thank you very much. Happy to talk further. We did record both sessions.